The young boy can feel an energy in the air. Something is up. Something is about to happen. He can feel it. As young as he is, he's learned to read the vibes in his home. And today feels bad, wrong, scary. Then he hears his mother scream. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 155, The Murder of Sonia Schwartz. Now it's time for my monthly tip about the latest series to watch on CBS Justice, the home of true crime on TV. And from Monday the 13th of May at 1:40 p.m. and 8 p.m, you can watch the South African premiere of the brand new series New York Homicide Season 2. Taking a deep dive into some of New York City's most shocking and unforgettable murder cases, New York Homicide gives viewers exclusive access to NYPD detectives as they race to solve a range of unique and complex cases. Watch a standalone episode Monday to Friday on DSTV Channel 170 and StarSat 222, repeated at the same time every weekend. And a huge thank you to CBS Justice for sponsoring this episode of True Crime South Africa. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming. And for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You? Yes, you are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at True Crime South Africa. /donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Nox Mbekeni, Carrie Lee, and Bianca for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout out on the pod, and other exclusive content, including Q&As with me, as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. I will admit that I thought twice about covering today's case, only because I discovered that the offender involved had taken a newspaper to the Press Council in 2013 because of their coverage of his crime. That hesitation was only momentary, though, because any decision I make for this podcast has to be based on one question. Does this serve the victim? And yes, I believe that telling Sonia's story does serve her memory, and I can only hope everyone who once loved her will agree. My decision was solidified by watching the coverage of this case on Heyskanoot's series Vlees en Bloed. The offender and Sonia's son contributed to that episode, so I was able to get a first-hand view of each of their feelings around what happened, and I can give that to you. And you can make your own call about how you feel about this tragic case. In addition to that series as a source, I also used the judgments from the offender's case with the Herald newspaper and an academic study in which this case was cited as a source. With that said, I'll be presenting the facts of this case to you and in places proffering my own personal interpretation of some of this evidence. And that is all it is, my personal interpretation. Whether or not you agree with it is completely up to you. So, let's get into episode 155, The Murder of Sonia Schwartz.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Sonia Louise was born on the 8th of June 1966. Although not much is known about her childhood and family, it would become clear later that she was quite close with her parents and had seemingly grown up in a loving family environment. After school, Sonia joined the police college in the hopes of becoming a police officer, and it would be while she was there that she met Davron David Schwartz. The man who went by Dave had had a very different childhood to Sonia. He had grown up in East London, and his family were incredibly poor. In Heiskenoot, Vlees en Bloed, Schwartz describes the circumstances of his childhood, how they didn't have a fridge, and him, his two brothers and sister often went hungry. In addition, Dave's father was an alcoholic, and his mother, thinking she could stop her husband from leaving the home on drinking binges, had started drinking herself. But her plan had backfired because she couldn't drink nearly as much as her husband, and she would soon pass out, Dave says, and then their father would go out anyway, and the four children would have no one to care for them. By the time Dave was 16, he could no longer take the suffering at home, and he reported his parents to the Department of Welfare. His siblings were removed from the home and placed in foster and state home care. Dave asked to be sent to a trade school so that he could learn some skills to earn money. Sadly, although it was a brave move on the boy's part, and his siblings would at least be cared for properly away from their parents, his youngest sister did not have a good experience in the state care system, and although there are no details about what she may have gone through and how much it actually impacted her mental health, Dave says that he believes it contributed significantly to her ultimate suicide when she was just 18 years old. Understandably, this is a really difficult childhood experience to have had, and while many may say, well, I also grew up poor, and my parents were also alcoholics, it's important to remember that each person's personal experience of their particular type of trauma is different. And if a person isn't particularly well-equipped to begin with, poverty and substance abuse in a family may impact them far more significantly than another person. Also, these things impact us in different ways anyway. There will always be some effects in adulthood, even for the most emotionally resilient. For some, it will look like being obsessive about spending or not spending money, hoarding, control issues, or even codependency. It emerges in a myriad of ways, and while we may not have asked for these experiences, it is our job to recognize how we've been impacted and stop that from negatively impacting others. From what Dave Schwartz says about his early understanding of mental health, it seems he had very little self-awareness about how his childhood could have impacted him by the time he joined the police college in the 70s. And this probably makes sense. It was a period where men were not supposed to show emotion. They had to be tough and not acknowledge any of their own suffering. In addition, Schwartz was entering a career where that would very much be the consensus too. The largely male-dominated South African police service at that time did very little to accommodate the mental health of its members. There were psychologists on staff, but it was largely frowned upon to engage with any of these services. Sadly, I know that this has actually not changed very much today. And so Schwartz began a career that would probably be the least healthy for a man like him who was already harboring some significant unhealed trauma. But Schwartz was intent on being successful in the SAP. Likely also as a result of his childhood, he wanted nothing more than to progress in the ranks and be a well-respected police officer. Schwartz has said that during his first few years as an officer, he played as hard as he worked, and he had a very active social life. So by the time he met the lovely young recruit, Sonia Louise, in 1988, he already knew that he was ready to settle down. Sonia also seemed to be instantly enamoured by the older officer, and despite her parents' protests, within 6 months, the couple had married. Sonia went on to graduate from police college, and although she had further aspirations for her career, she would have to put those on hold in 1990 when she fell pregnant with her first child. The couple's son was born, and just a year later, their daughter came into the world too. After her second child's birth, Sonia suffered from postnatal depression and received treatment, and Dave would say that this was the first time he'd started to think about mental health and his first experience, he claimed, of what depression was. It would later emerge that although Schwartz claimed to have no understanding of what negative or abnormal behaviour looked like until that point, his marriage with Sonia had been fraught with issues from the beginning. Through testimony and reports from those who knew the couple, it would be revealed that Dave Schwartz had displayed what a criminologist called controlling and obsessive behaviour toward his wife. At the time, these seemed to have been framed as a cultural thing. Schwartz bought into the man being the head of the household and woman being submissive rhetoric. But even that fails to explain, at least in my mind, some of the ways that it is alleged he attempted to control Sonia in their relationship. An example of this that was provided included Sonia not being allowed to watch television without David being present. He allegedly wanted her to only watch when he was there so that he could interpret any themes or information in the shows for her. David seemed to be quite a jealous man throughout their relationship, but this seemed to get worse when Sonia said she wanted to attend a course in Cape Town, which would help her to get promoted in the future. At first, David allegedly refused to let her go. Later, he agreed, but gave several conditions. These included her having to call him at specific times. She was not allowed to speak with any men if it was not directly related to the coursework. She was not allowed to go out at night with those she was on course with, and she had to return home every weekend. This type of controlling behaviour and David's constant, seemingly unfounded suspicions that his wife was being unfaithful continued, and in 1997, David went to see a psychologist. It's unclear from the information provided whether this was a police psychologist or someone external to the SAP, but the psychologist would diagnose David with depression and PTSD. Again, it's unclear whether the PTSD was from his childhood or from his work as a police officer, but the determination was that he should not continue working as a police officer and he could be medically boarded. David, though, decided that he did not want to be medically boarded. He had been promoted up through the ranks over the years, and his ultimate goal was to make the rank of general. He wasn't prepared to resign before he had achieved that, so the psychologist's recommendation was ignored. Throughout 1997, though, it becomes clear that the pressure was building in the Schwartz home. On the Fleece and Blut episode, David explains he had become suspicious that his wife was cheating on him, and he'd taken action to investigate these suspicions. He explains that one night, He had been watching television, and Sonia had opened a bottle of wine. After drinking the wine, David says he doesn't remember anything else about the night, and he woke up the next morning feeling strange. He claims he found unidentified tablets in his wife's handbag, which he believed were sedatives, and that Sonia had been drugging him in order to conduct an affair. He claimed that as part of his investigation, he had drawn itemized telephone billing for their landline and found that on the nights he believed he'd been drugged, several phone calls had come into his home. He firmly believed that he would have woken up if the phone had rung under ordinary circumstances, presumably because he was used to getting called out as a police officer, and this reinforced for him that he had been drugged by his wife. David said he had also found that there were many calls made to one specific number from his home phone, and it was not a number he knew. He went on to hire a colleague to help him investigate his suspicions further and followed Sonia, or had her followed. He went as far as bugging their phone so he could record her conversations. In one recording, he believed he had heard Sonia lower the volume of her voice and whisper to the person on the phone that they should meet in their special place. From those who report about Sonia's demeanor around this time, it seems clear that she was afraid. She had gone to her boss and confessed that David's mental health was spiraling out of control. She told him that she was afraid he was going to kill her, and soon after handed her and David's service weapons back to the SAP. David had taken sick leave from work, and his unoccupied mind seemed to only make things worse. He admits that he had struck Sonia on one occasion, saying that he had lost his patience with her. But it is unclear how many instances of domestic violence occurred during this time. Shortly after Sonia's conversation with her boss, she'd called in and asked for a day's leave. She said that David was losing control and she and his family were trying to find a bed for him at a psychiatric facility. On the 19th of October 1997, Sonia's son, who was then 7 years old, recalls feeling that the energy in the home was strange. He, of course, would understand little of what was happening, but he knew something was about to go down. David explains that on that day, he had asked some of his family members to come to his house to help him discuss the infidelity accusations with Sonia. He says he let his family members listen to the recording he'd made of her phone call, and they all agreed with him that Sonia was definitely whispering to someone to meet in their special place. Despite this, he says when everyone was gathered at the house with Sonia, they all denied being able to hear these words, and he was left as the only one supporting the belief. His family had another reason for being at the house, though. Once he had the talk he wanted to have about the recording, they were then going to take David to a psychiatric facility. They had managed to find a bed for him and hoped to be able to get him some treatment. The family meeting didn't yield the results David seemed to want, and so he began preparing to pack for his stay in the psychiatric ward. His brother left, and his aunt and uncle remained behind. He asked his aunt and uncle if they would go and draw cash for him, as he wanted to have some with him while he was away. Both left the house to carry out this task. On the episode of Blut in Fleers, Sonia's son describes what happened next. He and his sister were sitting in the lounge when they heard their mother scream. The boy ran into his parents' bedroom to find his father hacking at his mother with an axe. He immediately assailed his father, pushing at him with all his might to get him to stop, but his father flung him away and continued on. At some point, according to the autopsy report, Sonia must have attempted to wrap herself in the curtains to avoid getting hit again. Pieces of the curtain material were found embedded in her wounds. Sonia's son continued to assail his father, eventually pulling on his legs in an attempt to get him to fall over so he would stop attacking his mother. In his own explanation of what occurred that day, David says that he'd walked into the bedroom and Sonia was sitting on the bed. She'd looked at him and told him that she had been unfaithful and that she wanted to talk about it. David claimed that as soon as he heard those words, a hot feeling filled his head, and he didn't remember much after that, until he felt something tugging on his legs and looked down to see his son, and he realized he had an axe in his hand and his wife was laying on the floor, covered in blood. He gathered up his children into the car and went to the nearest SAPS office, where he handed himself over, telling the officer on duty that he had killed his wife. Sonia Schwartz was indeed deceased. She died relatively quickly from the severe axe wounds inflicted on her head and neck. By the time David's aunt and uncle returned to the house with the cash he'd sent them to draw, the home was swarming with police officers. Sonia's boss was called at his home by the officers at the scene to inform him of Sonia's murder and ask him to attend the Schwartz home and identify Sonia's body. The man did so and was shocked at the brutality of the attack on her. When he was informed of the identity of her attacker, he told the detectives on scene that Sonia feared something like this would happen. That night, Sonia's son and daughter, both deeply traumatized from what they had seen, slept at their mother's boss's home. The following day, they were collected by their grandparents. David Schwartz was officially arrested the following day and charged with murder and assault. He claimed that he did not remember the murder itself and was sure he had mentally snapped and had not had control over his actions at the time. His sister-in-law would later say, though, that he had told her that he had known what he was doing while he was doing it, and he knew it was wrong. He told her he had actually stabbed Sonia with a knife before hacking at her with an axe, although that point is not mentioned anywhere else. He told his sister-in-law that he had killed Sonia out of love, although he didn't elaborate on how this could be a loving act. Schwartz was sent for psychiatric evaluation in the run-up to his trial. Initially, he pleaded not guilty due to mental incapacity at the time of the murder. Soon, though, he asked to change his plea to guilty, but still stated in mitigation that he had not been fully in control of his actions at the time of his crime. Schwartz put forth that his PTSD had been triggered on the day of the murder by his wife allegedly admitting her infidelity, and he had perhaps gone into a dissociative state, so essentially he should be given a strongly reduced sentence for this reason. The prosecutor, though, believed that the murder had been premeditated and not committed in a dissociated state. Schwartz's obsessive and threatening behaviour in the run-up to the crime, his strange action of sending his aunt and uncle away from the house just before the murder, and the additional fact that the murder weapon, the axe, had been on the windowsill of the bedroom, all added up to premeditation in the mind of the state. According to commentary by a criminologist, Schwartz claimed that the axe had been on the windowsill because his 7-year-old son had been using it to try and build muscles. The judge, though, accepted David's guilty plea, and if the prosecution had thought they would still see a lengthy sentence, they were wrong. Although the prosecution had asked for a minimum of 15 years imprisonment, David Schwartz was handed down just 5 years. The prosecution appealed the sentence, but as Schwartz puts it in the episode of Flesh and Blood, "We got the great news that we had won, and my sentence remained unchanged." David Schwartz ended up serving 10 months in prison and the rest of his sentence on correctional supervision. Sonia's children would undergo many years of psychological treatments to deal with the trauma they had endured that day, and in the years ahead, they had no contact with their father. There's no mention from either side about whether David had attempted to make contact with his children, But his son says that he had eventually tracked his father down many years later simply because he wanted to tell him that he was not afraid of him anymore. This seemed an important step for the man, who by then was in his 30s, but he had had to live with the fear that the 7-year-old boy he had been still held for the man who had so viciously murdered his mother. David Schwartz said he had only ever wanted to have a relationship with his children, but his son says that there was absolutely no way that will ever happen. The young man is clear in saying that he thinks his mother was badly let down by the justice system and that his father's sentence was, in his words, pathetic. He says that the only thing he can do now is ensure he doesn't play the victim, as he says he feels his father has done. David Schwartz did not have contact with his own children, but in 2005 he got into a new relationship with a woman with 4 children of her own. In the television episode, he said that he had told his new girlfriend about his past, but he had not told her children. He would remain in a relationship with this woman for 8 years, until in 2013 he was appointed as an investigator at a local university, and a journalist from the Herald recognized his name and put 2 and 2 together. In 2009, David registered with the Private Security Industry Regulatory Authority, or PSIRA. This registration was necessary for him to apply to positions such as the one he received at the university, but persons with criminal records cannot register with PSIRA, so David applied and successfully had his record expunged. He had then applied for the position as investigator at the university and been successfully appointed in 2013 when he came to the journalist's attention. The journalist published an article about Schwartz and his crime. He said wanting to ensure the public knew that people with criminal records could have them expunged and end up working in environments like universities. David Schwartz took this journalist and the Herald newspaper to the press council over this article. There were a few points that he made in the hearing about why he felt the article was unethical, but he also said that there were statements attributed to him that he did not make, and some points were incorrect. In the judgment from the hearing, it states that Schwartz complained that he had worked hard to rebuild his life and had been waiting for the right time to tell his girlfriend of 8 years and her children about his past, but the article had revealed everything before he could. Now, I don't know how accurate that judgment from the press council is, but in 2022, when he appeared in the Hayes Knoet series, as I've mentioned, he said he had told his girlfriend when that article appeared, but not her children. And really, it's neither here nor there. But I would imagine if I'd been in a relationship with someone for 8 years, I would appreciate them sharing the fact that they had murdered their wife. Another aspect that Schwartz said was incorrect was that the article had said his record had been expunged in 2009 and he had documentation that said it was expunged in 2012. But the press council found the article had to have been correct because the PSIRA had registered Schwartz in 2009 and they would not have registered him if his record had not been expunged. So it had to have been done in 2009. At first, I couldn't figure out why this would be so important. But then I looked up the rules of expungement. And you can apply to have your record expunged 10 years after the expiration of your sentence. Schwartz's sentence was completed in 2002. That means that he would have been able to apply for expungement in 2012, which is what he was insisting had happened. If his record had indeed been expunged in 2009, then something untoward happened there. Either his expungement application was passed too soon, or his record was not expunged, and the PSIRA accepted his application regardless. The gist of his complaint was that the article did not exercise care and consideration regarding his privacy, dignity, and reputation, and that it was not in the public interest, and that the newspaper did not adequately consider the devastating effects that its, quote, sensationalistic story would have on him, on his relationships, and on his working environment. He added that the story contained several factual errors and omissions. I've already mentioned some of the factual errors Schwartz claimed were contained in the article. Others included that the article claimed he had said he'd murdered his wife in a state of near madness. Schwartz stated he felt that the statement was incorrectly attributed to him, and it made it seem as though he was trying to minimize his responsibility for the murder. Schwartz said, quote, "I've paid my debt to society. My record has been expunged. So why does the Herald have to once again mete out punishments to me by rekindling the emotions and hatred of the people who had forgotten about the tragedy or people who had now read the article for the first time and once again give judgments on me?" End quote. The newspaper insisted that despite all this, it was in the public interest to know this information. And although this, of course, would not form part of the hearing at the time, 9 years later, Schwartz would go on to willingly participate in coverage of the case by Heiskanoet. Schwartz also complained that the story had omitted the following information, which he had included in his interview with the journalist and he felt was relevant. He had explained how difficult correctional supervision had been and that he had had more than 400 sessions with psychologists and psychiatrists in order to understand how he could have done what he did. He had claimed that his son had contacted him 2 years before and told him that he could forgive him. On that point, I will just say that in the television episode, David's son only mentions finally tracking his father down in 2020 and telling him that he was no longer afraid of him. Schwartz also thought the public should know that he was in a new relationship with a woman for over 8 years and that she had just been discharged from hospital, that he had been a good policeman who had certificates for good service for 10 and 20 years. He would have liked to have seen some of his qualifications and achievements included, amongst which him being a founding member of an organization that assists ex-offenders to get skills in order to reintegrate them into society. In the end, while the press council did find that the article had been in the public interest, it also found that the paper had acted without concern for the harm it may cause Schwartz. It also found that the journalists did not have sufficient proof of the statements they'd included that Schwartz had disputed. The journalist said his recorder had stopped recording at that point, but he'd written them down word for word, but the council found this to be insufficient proof. As such, those comments had to be considered inaccurate. The omissions claims were set aside as the council understood that limited space was available for such an article, and omitting these things did not make the article unbalanced. The Herald was asked to print an apology to David Schwartz for any harm they had caused him and for the apparent inaccuracies. So, let's be clear here. David Schwartz does not deny that he is responsible for the murder of his wife. He has served his time and his record has been expunged. Let's have that on record. I have seen no complaints by Schwartz to the content in the Heiskanoet episode, though. And that was video recorded, and he very well seemed to be willingly participating. So, I think it's safe to assume he was not unhappy with that coverage. And no, he does not say outright in that episode that he was not responsible for the murder of his wife due to mental incapacity. He does, however, describe not having awareness of what he was doing at the time of the murder, and that he came to and realized he had an axe in his hand. A criminologist describes this as being very similar to a mental incapacity defense. But I don't know. I'm not a criminologist. What I can't shake, though, and this is the reason I actually decided to cover this case, is the significant time Sonia's murderer takes to describe the build-up to the murder and his actions in investigating his suspicions of infidelity. It is clear to me that even today, he is convinced that Sonia had been unfaithful. And unless it's been edited out, which I doubt, he doesn't at any time acknowledge how terrifying, bizarre, and abusive his behavior toward her was. After over 400 sessions with psychologists, I would at least like to have seen some self-awareness over the controlling and obsessive behavior exhibited. Instead, I feel, and this is just my take, that some blame is laid for her own murder at the victim's door. So let me be clear on something else. 27 years later, Sonia Schwartz is not here to stand up for herself. She's not here to explain how terrified she must have been in the run-up to her murder, or what horror went through her mind as an axe rained down blows on her head. But there is absolutely nothing she could have done to deserve that. Nothing. I personally find it quite unlikely that she was being unfaithful, and even if she was, that means nothing. And for someone who killed her to go on camera and vividly describe how they believed they were being drugged and lied to by the woman who was actually so afraid for her life that she removed all weapons from her home and told her boss she thought her husband would kill her, is just a little poor. Well, it's actually very poor. But that's just my personal interpretation of this person's own recorded statements. Through this journey, I have met and even become friends with people who have committed crimes in their past. Some pretty heinous ones. And I can honestly say that those individuals show a deep and true understanding of rehabilitation and remorse. Not once have those individuals blamed anyone except themselves for their crimes, not even in implication. Not once have they ever spoken of anything their victims did as playing any role in their crimes. They know they bear ultimate responsibility. And that, in my mind, is the difference. Sonia's son and daughter, who I do not name out of respect for them, chose not to have any relationship with their father. They were there that day. They knew what happened. They had some understanding, at least, of what was happening in their home in the years before the crime. And they have chosen not to have a relationship with the person who killed their mother. And that tells me everything I personally need to know to form an opinion. You can decide for yourself. Sonia Schwartz is still dead. She had her life cut short, and her children have had to live with how that happened and who did it. Nothing changes that. And although I personally think this case would have played out differently in our courts today than it did in 1997, we can't turn back time. But is it in Sonia's interests for her terrible experience to be recounted and understood and not forgotten? Yes, I think it is. If you know anything about domestic violence and intimate partner murder, you would have picked up on the red flags as I described how this murder played out. Sonia was afraid for a very long time. That says a lot to me, at least. Sonia Schwartz, rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, Please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.